It's a real pleasure to welcome Ken Majmudar to this conversation. Those of you who've been in our community will know Ken either from one of our offline events or from his presentations and interviews that we've shared on our website. Ken founded Ridgewood Investments in 2002 and serves as its chief investment officer. Ken has shared not just interesting ideas with our members, but also wisdom on living well with us as well. And so I'm really grateful, Ken, that you're taking some time to help us make sense of this turbulent situation here. I'll just turn it to you for some initial remarks, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure, John. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to interact with the MOI community. And for everyone out there that might be listening, hope everyone's staying safe and staying prudent. I've done a few of these calls now over the last few days. And I've thought, you know, quite a bit about what's going on. So I'm happy to share. I think where I'd like to kick it off is obviously observing something that just to put some context around it. So this is a black swan event. And of course, I'm referring to that great book that came out, I don't know, about 7, 8 years ago, maybe a little longer, by Nicholas Nassim Taleb. So just to remind everyone, a black swan event is something that is very low probability of happening, but very high severity if it happens. And in markets, we know that from time to time, there are black swans that happen. We unfortunately don't know when they're going to happen, and we don't really know what form they're going to take or what kind of ultimate impact that they're going to have. But they do happen from time to time. And this is one that suddenly happened. Obviously, the last sort of black swan that I lived through was 9/11, and both are exogenous events. So they're events that, you know, back in November, no one in the world was saying, "Hey, there's going to be a virus from China and it's going to spread globally and shut down economies everywhere." So, you know, this is very much a black swan event. So I just want to start there.
All right. Well, in terms of the situation leading into this black swan event, it seems like we were already very high on the complacency scale in the market. The VIX was really low. Valuations were elevated. So did that exacerbate this situation?
Well, yeah, I think so. But I mean, I guess it depends on what we're talking about by the situation. So let me just kind of break that out a little bit in terms of how I'm thinking about it. So obviously, the situation in the markets is being driven by the situation in the world. And so let's start with the situation in the world, then we can talk about the situation in the markets. So in the world, what's happening is this virus that started in China. It's sort of a little bit of a perfect storm, so to speak. It's very highly communicable. And through global linkages, it's really pretty much spread everywhere. And it seems to be one of these things where people are asymptomatic and it spreads even when they're asymptomatic. So even if, you know, they don't know that they have a viral load that they're spreading, then that's what's making it so effective in terms of its ability to spread. So let's look at the virus itself, what we know about it, because it has implications for the market and what's going on. Based on everything I've read, the research, so 80% of the people seem to have a relatively mild experience, sort of like a flu. It's a fever, maybe a cough. It resolves on its own. Apparently, what they're guessing is that about 2 days before you have any symptoms, and then up to probably the average is sort of like 10 to 12 days after, you may be able to pass it on. So you may be contagious. And so that's what's, you know, leading to a lot of the spreading of this everywhere. That's for the 80%. And then in the other 20%, you know, they have a more significant health issues, of which something like 5% are ICU type cases. So the real issue and why we're doing all of this social curtailment, which I'm obviously all for, is that it particularly seems to hit hard. And it's, by the way, not exclusively limited to folks above, you know, 60 or 70 in particular. There are cases of younger folks, you know, being affected significantly, but obviously it's disproportionately affecting vulnerable populations. That would be older folks. And then there's this term called comorbidities. So people with diabetes, people with heart issues and things like that. So a lot of the younger folks, and like schools, you could pass it on through children potentially, but then they bring it back to people that are more vulnerable. That's really the biggest issue. And then the reason we're doing the social distancing is because we're trying to flatten the curve, as they're saying, so that emergency rooms everywhere don't get overwhelmed by that 5%. So that's really the goal of all of this. Now, in terms of the markets, there's really two factors there, I think. So one is economic and the other one is psychological. And on the economic side, I think a lot because of the social distancing and the disruptions, there's the economic activity is obviously plummeting. It's falling off a cliff. And it makes sense why it would do that, because economic activity requires, for most of it, it requires interaction and it requires confidence. And so when something like this happens, a virus out of sort of nowhere that no one was expecting, that we're not immune to because it's a new one that we've never seen before, and there's no therapies, we'll get to that in a second. It's tremendously scary for a lot of people because it has kind of a risk associated with it, including a morbidity. So it hits psychology, but in order to try to flatten that curve, as we've talked about, governments are basically forced to curtail interaction so that the spreading really slows way down. And in doing so, they basically have to, and they are shutting down restaurants. People aren't going to travel for a lot of reasons. You know, cruise ships, all of those things. And that's the first order effects. And then the second order effects are the people that supply to them, the people that work for them. So these are profound economic slowdowns. And by the way, you know, in case anyone's wondering, and obviously it should be relatively obvious, you know, we are in a global recession because the definition of recession is a slowdown in economic activity. By definition, that's what this is. It's an exogenous event that's forcing a curtailment of a tremendous amount of economic activity in the world. So we are in a recession. It's global, unfortunately, because of the amount that this has spread and the measures that we have to take so that our emergency rooms don't get overwhelmed like they have gotten in Italy, and they were getting in China and so forth. So that's on the economic side. And what that means is the next, I think in the United States, where we're at the beginning of this spreading, beginning-ish, if you look just this week versus the end of last week, there's huge declines in, for example, restaurants. OpenTable is a booking website where you could book a dinner table. They actually just days ago, I think, opened up all of their data. So you can go on there and find a spreadsheet where they disclose like what's going on country by country, wherever the OpenTable is used, city by city, state by state. You can see restaurants bookings, for example, are off 50, 60, 70%, which is not surprising. So you have a tremendous and a profound slowdown in economic activity, which is caused by this exogenous event, i.e. the virus, and people basically staying, distancing themselves. And then you have the psychological effect. So it's a double whammy. And on the psychology side, the issue there is, hey, there's this new threat that nobody expected. It was a surprise. It overloads our brains, right? So we have a logical part of our brain and we have an emotional part of our brain. And something like this happening, it provokes a fear response and a survival instinct, and it floods our brains with emotions and mostly fear and panic. So that overwhelms any logical parts of our brain that are more recently evolved. And then that reflects in the decisions that we make across the board. So obviously in markets, what we do as we see stuff happening in markets, but also, you know, I mean, obviously you hear about people, you know, running to the store and buying all the hand sanitizer or like cleaning out the toilet paper. It's related to this fear-based response. So when you have those working in combination, you have an actual economic event, which has some profound impacts. Like for example, all of those restaurants, they employ a lot of people, and a lot of those people live paycheck to paycheck. The restaurants, now their revenue has just gone down week over week, you know, 50, 70%. They have rent, they have other bills. How do they pay their staff? Are they going to let go some of their staff? They're probably going to have to. Most restaurants don't run with a huge cash cushion. So then those folks are living paycheck to paycheck. They're, you know, maybe they're renting somewhere. How are they going to make their rent next month? Because they don't have cushions of cash to pay their rent. That then goes to the landlord who's renting to them, who, you know, had a 2 or 3% or 4% bad debt assumption in their financials. Now suddenly they're bad debt because, you know, a third of their tenants have no jobs just suddenly. That can carry forward. So these are the kinds of cascading waves of interconnection, which is part of the economic effect of these curtailments. And the market obviously anticipates the future and it discounts the future. So this event is very real. It's global in impact. And that is part of what's causing the markets to decline so quickly. That and psychology, it's a two-part cocktail.
What have you been able to find out about the virus itself and the likelihood or estimated timeline of getting to some sort of a vaccine or cure?
Sure. Well, I've looked at a number of things. So I think I'm just trying to lay like a hopefully helpful framework or helpful groundwork. I think people should remain calm. I think there is reason to be optimistic on a couple of different fronts. So first is that we are doing this social curtailment, even though it has a heavy cost economically in the short term. I believe it is probably the right thing to do to slow down that curve, because I guess my nightmare scenario would be we didn't do this and our hospitals get, you know, there's thousands of people rushing our ER rooms. That would be a nightmare for our healthcare workers and for our societies. So we needed to do this to slow this down. So what are the reasons to be optimistic? Well, first of all, the biggest overarching reason to be, you know, guardedly optimistic is that this is a time-bound event. I used an analogy. It's like we're at war, but this is not a war that's going to last 4 years like World War II. This is a war that's probably going to last, you know, 2-3 months, maybe a little bit longer. So it's going to be an intense but short duration event. So what will make it short duration? There's a number of different possibilities here. You mentioned a vaccine. Everything I've read suggests that it takes a bit more time to develop a vaccine. So the timelines that I've seen probably suggest that normally, even if you work very fast, a vaccine can take about a year plus or minus, because you have to make sure it's effective and safe. You know, maybe could be a little shorter than that, but that's not really probably going to be too useful in this outbreak. However, there are a few other mitigating factors. So a vaccine is something you give to prevent symptoms ahead of time and to build the body's immune response ahead of time. Fortunately, this is happening at a time and in a world where we are, our technology is very, very advanced. For those that, haven't followed, they've already and very quickly sequenced the virus. This particular one, I think there's viruses that are DNA. This one's RNA. So ribonucleic acid, it's a little segment of genetic material. It replicates itself by hijacking your own cells, and then it uses you as a host to, as you cough, you know, spread it airborne widely. For one thing, I mean, obviously, there was a, if you want to look at an analog in a different time, it was Spanish flu killed, I don't know, 30 or 50 million people. It's a pretty big chunk of the population back then. Back when we didn't have the technologies that we have, the therapies, the understanding, et cetera. So we live in a kind of a relatively a golden age where within weeks we've sequenced the virus. We know what it is. We know what family it is. There's other viruses in this family. The best minds in infectious diseases and virology and stuff are working on this. There's a tremendous, obviously, priority put into this. So that makes me quite optimistic. I think the first things that we're going to see are not going to be vaccines because of the time required. I think that will be kind of the long-term solution. But I think what we'll see probably before that is therapies. So therapies will be when people have the symptoms to help them get better quicker with less morbidity. And so the most likely candidates on that front are going to be therapies that already exist for other things. So they weren't made to treat coronavirus, but there are antivirals, for example, that were created, I think, for HIV, which is also a virus, or some other virus, maybe other coronaviruses like SARS. And they're going to try to see which ones of those might work against this one. So a therapy that already exists, it's called off-label use. So a therapy that already exists but happens to work with this one, that will be much quicker, I think, than a vaccine. And there's already candidates, like, for example, there's a company called Gilead, which has a lot of expertise in this area. They actually have a candidate that may be effective against coronavirus. Now, I believe that it's not approved in the United States, but they had mailed, I think, like 500 or something like that samples to Japan and some other countries when they were in the midst of this outbreak, like a month or a month and a half ago. And what I read, it seemed to have worked, so that there were some critical cases. They gave them this antiviral, and it seemed to help a lot of them resolve, maybe even all of them resolve their symptoms. So that's very promising. There's other candidates like that. Similarly, to give you a glimpse, now we're in a world, we've sequenced the virus. So there's an article about IBM used one of their supercomputers, and it already is programmed to do this type of thing. So they feed in information about the virus, its structure and whatnot. They were able to identify 70 different candidates that might have antiviral properties against this virus. All of this is sort of amazing type of technology. So we're just caught because this thing is so new. But one thing that makes me optimistic is that our science is going to catch up to this threat. How long will it take is not known, but given the importance of it, I would not be surprised if within the next, few months, 1, 2, 3, 4 months, we probably will have some therapies that have some efficacy, and they'll probably be rushed to market. So that's one line of attack or defense, so to speak. Of course, one of the things with this is it's sort of like a super flu, which affects 5% you know, very heavily. But it will run its course. So, it's going to go through the population. A lot of us are going to be infected at some point. The idea of social distancing is to sort of not have everybody get infected all at once or as quickly. And again, for 80%, it's just like a flu like experience, which actually brings me to another point. So I think the numbers you're seeing of the cases, if I think about it, if I had to guess, are vastly undercounted. So whatever number you see in the headlines, I don't know what it is in the United States right now. It's several thousands, I think, at least. The true number is probably very, very far in excess of that, maybe 10 times, 15 times, maybe even as high as 20 times, if I had to guess. And the reason is because 80% don't really present very significant symptoms. They are having basically a fever, some cough maybe, and then it resolves within a week or so. Those numbers are not being counted properly. And also in many countries, and definitely the United States, the testing capacity isn't there. So it's really only the sickest people that are being tested. And that means that the true number is much greater than the number you read. The good news with that is that that probably also means that eventually when we kind of figure out the true numbers that must have gotten infected and whatever, the morbidity statistics are probably overstating the morbidity by some factor. So it's definitely deadlier than the flu, but it's probably not as deadly as the numbers you're seeing, which is something like 2 or 3%. But it's 2 or 3% of this, probably of a lot of the sickest people for whatever reason. They're not always the oldest people either, but for whatever reason, they got the worst symptoms. So they went to the hospital and then a number of them got tested with a very limited testing capacity. So the other thing, other two things which are speculative. So one is viruses, even without all of the therapies and things, which I fortunately, we have a lot of, you know, advanced medicine here now. These things do run their course. Usually, like China's probably took about 10 weeks, but they took very aggressive measures. So if you look at the Spanish flu, you know, it was a longer period of time, but whatever period of time that there is, you know, 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, it runs through the population. Like I said, 80% have mild symptoms, 15% have more, 20% have more significant symptoms, of which 5% end up, you know, having to get really significant treatment and maybe a ventilator and things like that. And then a greater percentage of those have morbidity. But even a bunch of those recover. So when it moves through the world and the, you know, this concept of herd immunity, at some point, a lot of us become immune to it just through natural causes. Now, by the way, I'm not an immunologist, so I'm just basing it on sort of my knowledge level and whatever I've been reading. But it's not clear whether this gives you permanent immunity or temporary immunity or no immunity. But I don't think you hear about too many people having caught it again. It's not in the papers anyway. So it's probably at least giving temporary immunity. So that even without therapies and things, it would have a kind of an endpoint where it wouldn't be necessary anymore to have all the social distancing and things. So, and one other thought, which is again, a little bit speculative, is that I have noticed, and I've also read, that the hotter countries seem it's there, but it doesn't spread as widely and as quickly. So I would also be guessing, but I think it's a reasonable guess that hot weather impedes the spreading a bit. So here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're in March, it's March 17th today. We're gonna fortunately be going into warmer weather within the next, you know, roughly 6 weeks. So if that's correct, and it's not a guarantee, that may also help some. So between all of these things, I think that what we're looking at is a very severe event, but it's a time-bound event, and we are going to get through it probably my best guess, the next 2 to 4 months are going to be the toughest period.
So I agree with you that it's a time-bound event. It's perhaps, you know, a prime example of a time-bound event. You kind of know we're going to get through this one way or another. Why then this kind of a market reaction? Why are investors not able to see through it and say, okay, we have no earnings for a year, what does that do to valuations? And I think if you do those analyses in a very rational way, you're going to basically reduce your fair value estimates by some kind of a single digit percentage.
Right.
So why are we looking at this kind of a collapse?
So I think a few different reasons, right? So one is that, which we touched on before, is that there's a psychological aspect and an economic aspect. And let's look at both sides. So on the economic aspect, and you know, my best guess, the severest part of this will be the next 2 to 4 months. And I could be wrong, right? It could be a little, longer. It could be a little shorter. But in the United States, it's ahead of us. So first of all, I think fortunately with the social distancing, maybe the headline numbers will not grow as quickly as they otherwise would have. But they're going to grow. They're going to grow quite a bit. And there's probably about a 2-week lag. So I think Italy put in their draconian measures of containment about, I don't know, 1.5, 2 weeks ago. So the numbers have been growing. We're only going to know in another few days whether the curtailment that happened 2 weeks ago is really going to slow the thing down. So those are the types of things that we have to kind of deal with. But so psychologically, we're looking at worse and worse headlines. And as much as we'd like to all think that, well, investors are just purely calculating machines, we all know that that's not in fact true, that human psychology and human feeling and emotion has a great deal to do with the decisions that we make. So that's one aspect of it. People are scared, and rightly so. There's a threat that is an unknown threat that is, a new threat, and that actually causes a certain amount of morbidity. That's scary, and our brains get overloaded, and we get scared. And when we're scared, we don't sit there and calculate future cash flows, obviously. So that's sort of one aspect to it. The other aspect to it, and this is very important, is that the market, it's that famous saying, the market in the short term is a voting machine, and in the long term, it's a weighing machine. I think that's either a Ben Graham quote via Buffett or some other equally wise person, an insightful person. So what happens right now is, okay, you know, if you have your portfolio, I mean, this is just in general, right? What is the stock market? We have to remind ourselves, it's where little pieces of companies trade, and they trade based on the supply and demand for that particular company on that particular day at that particular moment, right? So everybody's scared right now, and there's all this uncertainty, and their brains are saying danger, danger, and it's flooding them with emotions and overwhelming their logical commerce sides, right? And then I guess some of them are selling because they're scared, and some of them might be selling because they need money. Maybe they didn't plan to have liquidity and have a cushion like we tell our clients to do, to not invest money that they can't afford to leave alone. So, but either way, you're going into the market. Remember, it's a secondary market and it's an auction market. And you're saying, hey, I want to sell, you know, my whatever, 100 shares of Apple or my 200 shares of this ETF, right? Any takers, right? And a bunch of people are selling it because they're scared. And So you have to entice somebody to buy it in a time when there's a lot of sellers and everybody's scared. So naturally, if somebody's going to step up and buy, they're going to say, well, this is my price. And if you're not really price sensitive, so you're just willing to sell it, that is what's reflected in a market during a time of panic. I think the important thing to remember is that there's a distinction between price and value. And what we're seeing in the market is the price. That's the clearing price that somebody is willing to buy and somebody's willing to sell in a time when there's many sellers and there's a lot of fear. But to your point, John, the value is not necessarily the price. The value, to your point, and I agree with your point, is based on cash flows. So if I'm correct, and I may not be, but I think it's much more likely than not, that this is, number one, it's a time-bound event. That's extremely likely. And two, that my time estimate is somewhere in the ballpark of 2 to 4 months. So the economic activity has fallen off a cliff. So we're in a recession. I believe this will be a V-shaped event. So just as quickly as economic activity has fallen off a cliff, I think it will come back once we got the green light because either a therapy was developed or it's spread enough or the warmer weather helps or whatever the reasons, it will be okay to go out again and eat at restaurants and go about your normal life. If I'm correct that it's probably a 2-quarter event roughly. So our valuations today should be based on, let's say, the next 10 years of cash flows. You're right that if 2 quarters out of a year of cash flows go away out of 10 years and the rest of the 10 years is roughly the same as it was going to be, the value should only go down a little bit, but the price, as I explained, would go down a lot. And this actually means that if you are willing to take a longer term horizon, which many people aren't in these circumstances, then it represents an opportunity. I've said this to a few other groups that asked my opinion. I do feel extremely confident that a year from now or 18 months from now, our lives will be more or less back to normal with the appropriate sort of adjustments and modifications to try to address some of the vulnerabilities that caused this in the first place. But because it's a time-bound event. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not 2 to 4 months. Maybe it's 3 to 6 months. Maybe it's more than 6 months. But I don't think there's much of a chance that a year from now we're still where we are today. So mathematically, the valuations should not go down this much. But for the reasons that we just talked about, there's a gap between price and value. By the way, also there's another reason is liquidity, which is related to why somebody would be a forced seller. So this is a time when you do need cash. You have all these businesses that are seeing their revenues drop, and they're going to need cash. They're going to need cash to survive. Now, obviously, the government has a role to play in this, and they're doing that. So I think they're going to come up with measures, perhaps even airdrop money, which is probably a logical approach, give all of these folks some money and save all these businesses. Because remember, the economic engine, the economic system is supposed to figure out who should stay in business and who should get more resources and who should go out of business. When an exogenous event like this happens, that's going to be 2, 3, 4, 5 months, it clogs up the engine. So you don't necessarily want companies going out of business because of this reason, because they need to be back in business when this ends. So you probably want to find a way to bridge them over the hump. So hopefully that's helpful perspective.
Tell us, if you would, a little bit about what you're doing in your client portfolios. How are you thinking about rebalancing or perhaps, moving capital from ideas that maybe you don't like as much to others that now seem even more compelling?
Yeah, so I think that, that's all exactly the part of the process. Now, we always run with some cash, so that this is a time over the next few weeks to put some of that cash to work. Automatic rebalancing sort of does that too, in that whatever proportion of bonds or safer investments people were comfortable with, bonds actually would have rallied through this crisis if they were high quality. Now the stocks would have gone down, so you would sell some of your bonds and buy some stocks. So that would be another approach. I don't think that we're necessarily out of the woods yet, because I think that headline number is going to potentially keep going up quite a bit. So I think there's going to be still some scary news ahead of us that probably will drive the market potentially down some more. Of course, the market does discount the future, so it's not going to wait till everything is smooth sailing. The market will anticipate that going forward. Obviously, yesterday was a big down day. Today, it was up some. But I don't think we're yet out of the woods. I mean, ultimately, once we have a therapy, that's going to give people a lot of, a lot of relief. And then once we have a therapy, we could even relax some of the social distancing measures and things. So I think the market was down, 9 to 12% yesterday. In the United States, the markets are up, 4 or 5% today. It's close to the end of the trading day. But I don't think we're out of the woods yet. However, all these measures that the Fed is taking, the federal funds rate went to, I think, 0%. Which I don't remember that has ever happened before in my lifetime that I can remember. So there's going to be a lot of liquidity put into the market. And then that liquidity is probably still going to be there even after we see the light at the end of the tunnel. So again, the market's not going to wait till we're out of the tunnel. But once we start to see the light, or we start to anticipate it even, the market is going to start rallying. And all this liquidity that came in is ultimately going to probably drive asset values up. Interest rates are low. Mortgages can be refinanced. So there's a lot that can happen that will be on the positive side. So I think there are obviously a number of opportunities and companies that are already attractive. And it will be, I think, the case over the next 6 to 8, maybe 10 weeks, the case counts are going to go up to much, much larger numbers than there are today. And keeping in mind that they're already much larger than the headlines. So that's probably going to scare people. There's going to be some bad headlines. But if you're willing to look out a year to 18 months, and certainly if you're looking out over the next 10 years, I think on balance, this is going to present a great opportunity to buy great companies and great assets. And so if you have cash, you can buy. If you have lesser quality companies, you can upgrade to better companies or better upside. I think all of those opportunities, or you can rebalance. All of those opportunities present themselves. You have to, most investors will not look out past what's going on right now. It's hard to do that, especially when you're scared. But of course, if it was easy, everybody would be rich. It's not. So, but this will be one of those times. It already is, but somewhere over the next 4 to 6 weeks, I think there'll be more scary things that happen, but ultimately it'll be a great opportunity to buy great investments. I'm confident the world is not going to end.
And I think the conversation we're having now, we're sort of looking through this in a way. And it would seem to me that, it's been a shock to people that what happened in Italy or in other places will happen pretty much everywhere to some degree or another.
Correct.
But now that shock is absorbed, you know, it's not a huge leap to kind of look through to the, hopefully to the end of this, which is a time-bound event that we flatten the curve and get through this.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see whether we get additional surprises that will shock us, you know, like complete breakdowns of civil service. If, you know, if a place like New York City is quarantined, what could go wrong there in terms of just supplying basic necessities mm-hmm. to the people?
So those are the types of things that could happen. So far, I mean, I'm in the New York area. People have stayed pretty calm. It's pretty normal. So I don't expect anarchy to break out. I think most of the world is functioning, and I think it's not out of the question. But the good news, among other good news, is that number one, 80% of the people are fine. So you get a fever and you're okay. So because of that, I think we can keep the world functioning if 80% of the people are fine. So that I think the anarchy scenario isn't top of mind in terms of what I'm worried about. And I think that with 80% of the people that are basically fine, we can keep, you know, supermarket store shelves stocked and more or less all the functions of society, police, fire, et cetera, more or less functioning. There may be shortages in some things and whatnot, but I think those we can work through. However, as an example of something that could be another exogenous thing, I think right now there's kind of a sense that China's out of the woods because they're at the tail end of the 10 weeks, but there's a potential for this to go back, you know, from global, because we're still a linked world. You know, we've cut down the flights, whatever, and maybe not now, but maybe in a month or two when we open things up, there could be another spike up. So ultimately, what really will put a floor on this will be a therapy that we think works. Because remember that therapy or therapies, which it's very likely they already exist. We just need to make sure that they work here. And then the antivirals, the protease inhibitors, and then there's the ability to take antibodies from people that have already recovered. So all of those are possibilities. The reason we need to do social distancing, remember, is to not overwhelm the emergency rooms, which have a bottleneck in terms of beds and respirators and personnel. That's the reason for the social distancing. As an aside, there's an article, people can Google it, of how Philadelphia and St. Louis responded to the Spanish flu. And in Philadelphia, they didn't do social distancing. They actually had a parade and like everybody got it. And a bunch of people died. In St. Louis, they did do social distancing. So what happened is in total, the number of deaths cumulatively were like half in St. Louis than in Philadelphia. But in Philadelphia, you saw a big spike and then a big decline as it kind of moved through everybody very quickly. Interestingly enough, in St. Louis, it took longer. So there was a slower increase that lasted longer and then eventually declined. So ultimately, the St. Louis thing both saved lives and it prevented the same amount of a rush on hospitals and stuff, or at least the same amount of caseload all at once. But it prolonged it. So the Philadelphia thing was sort of done by 6 weeks or something. Everybody had it. St. Louis, it went like twice that long. But cumulatively, it looked like social distancing was still the way to go. So if this is effective, it'll probably prolong things a little bit. But ultimately, the thing we need and what will happen is there'll be a therapy or therapies, and then with enough time, a vaccine. That is also, I mean, it's extremely likely that we're going to have a therapy or therapies within some, you know, within that time frame that I'm talking about. I think 2 to 4 months, we're going to have some therapies or something. That'll make people feel a lot better and we'll be able to treat a lot more. Then we won't need to do so much social distancing, even if people catch it, we'll just give them a therapy. And then when we have the vaccine, then that'll really put an end to this pretty much.
If I want to look at a silver lining here, I think what I'm looking at is, you know, 5 years ago, Bill Gates in a TED talk warned of this and
Absolutely.
Said we're not prepared for a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, this one, it doesn't look like it's going to kill us all. I mean, that could have been a possibility and we're not
sure.
prepared.
Right.
So I'm kind of thinking ahead for my kids' lives.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this will be a warning sign, a warning that's stark enough that we are going to have some kind of a global task force, some kind of a response system that in the future we can deal with these things much better because they're not going away.
Yep.
Pandemics.
No, absolutely. So I've seen that Bill Gates TED talk. It's actually worth seeing. He was absolutely prescient in the way he described it, the possibility, and it's very much describing what's happened. And we are lucky that ultimately the mortality here is probably going to, my guess, probably going to get revised down to between maybe 0.5% to 1%, because we're not really counting all the actual cases that are out there that are self-resolving. And relatively speaking, we're seeing that how much of a global impact it can have. I mean, the cost economically is going to be extremely high, though concentrated most likely within the next 4 to 6 months, 3 to 6 months. So obviously, no matter what the cost is of taking measures against something like this, it's going to be worth it. And it's obvious to everybody, every government. Nobody wants to go through this again. And it's too costly in lives and in treasure. So I think we're going to see globally a significant amount of policy and investment to deal with the next one, which whenever that happens, which it's inevitable that there'll be other ones, we'll be better prepared. And even simple measures like stockpiling, things we'll need, you know, a lot of these things end up being respiratory. So respirators, the ability to create, you know, contingency plans on creating beds if there's a pandemic, you know, training a core of people like, just like a standing, we have a standing army, we might need a standing medical core. Tremendous implications. And I agree with you, John, that this will be tremendously positive. And not just for our children. I mean, how old are you right now, roughly?
43.
You're 43. I'm 50. Obviously, this is going to hit people over 70 the hardest in terms of lasting impacts. So it's going to benefit us too. If this is a wake up call, which it clearly is, and we do something about it, because we realize the cost is too high in lives and in disruption. And we have the technology. And the technology is only going to get better and quicker. The reason we sequence the virus so quickly is, you know, we have PCR and other technologies. It didn't take very long at all. So there's a number of things that are good that will come out of this.
Well, on that note, Ken, I'll... thank you very much for taking the time to share your perspective. Very insightful. I really enjoyed the conversation. I want to wish you and your family all the very best in this time.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
Goodbye for now.